country, we can do that, you know.
I mean, people feel like they're on opposite sides, and they can listen to each other.
So you've got to bring that up. We have to have this conversation again.
So
I want the whole group to
Liz, do we have another one?
No, but I can go print one out.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, but me
but
too.
I'd read it all.
You know, it's a good start.
We're just sharing.
You know,
we can share
shelter
here.
Okay. That night, okay. Another group that I was that I normally go to that I didn't go to.
We got 3 minutes.
I know it's been Mondays and silence. I don't know.
One.
I was like, oh no, I have to talk
four, five,
to you.
So we're good.
But I'm sure Sarah
but we'll
will
wait 3 more minutes.
My attention circle that I go to, they know
and then we
I
also go.
And so I just take right my attention out. Like I kind of receive other people's attention. I'm just going to be in meditation. That's what I was doing anyway.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
So it's pretty easy. But this was like, I'm pretty sure I have to talk.
Yeah.
Did you get my email?
Tuesday at 3.
Oh, wow.
Tuesday.
Not only did he get it, he
He's
noted
all over.
When he got
no, I'm noting a response.
Oh,
a potential one that works for you.
Pretty sure it does.
She is in Eugene. Okay. What is she doing in Eugene? She's giving.
There's an Oregon Planning Association meeting, so she's presenting on some affordable housing.
Oh, I remember. She did not like to present. She wanted you to do.
Well, yes,
you
she did.
All the experience of the presentation.
She'll be great. I mean, a superstar of Oregon.
Yeah, I mean, where you present what you know. And so she doesn't have to go into all the minutiae of land use. She can present about housing programs.
Right here.
To Brandon.
Thank you.
You know Ken, yeah.
I know Brandon.
Okay, Brandon.
You'll see something on there that says...
That is cute.
You'll see something on there that says city presentation. Always.
Tuesday at 3 is perfect.
At 6:37, is that right?
Mm-hmm. You can park in back.
Yeah.
There's parking in the alley behind it. Did you hear me?
Yeah.
How's Robbie doing?
He's doing great.
I'm going to turn off my phone.
Still going to the center?
He is.
Okay.
He is. He went today.
That's great.
And I was gone all morning, and so I just got back at 10:30. I'm like, ready to go in a half hour? And he was like, sure. I left him to put on his socks, and then I could, like, get him to take him out of the car, and he has his shoes on and no socks. And I'm like, no socks? It's a fashion statement.
Oh, that's cute.
Whatever. I don't care if you wear socks.
That's cute. Yeah. A lot of guys don't these days. It is a fashion statement.
He's a southern boy. He gets cold so fast.
Oh.
And so, you know, it's you know, like weather like this, he's going to need like a jacket and a hat, and, you know, zip it up. And he's like,
right.
I'm like, but no socks? Like, aren't your ankles cold? I don't know.
Get a little muffler.
Yeah.
I did.
So.
Well, that's good. I'm so glad.
Those people are amazing.
Yes.
They are truly amazing.
Yeah, you talk about Natalie and Eileen and Corey, and yes, they are.
I mean, they just like, you know, Walter's here. Let's get his iced tea.
And Jane.
Yeah.
Jane Davis.
Oh, let me get your iced tea started. And he just kind of beams like, they remember.
Oh, that's so great.
Just little things like that. But just
I just love them. Natalie is one of my very favorites. She's just so sincere and... Just make sure everyone's included, and it's so nice.
Everybody knows your name.
Yes.
Oh, is it
okay?
Time?
Yep. It's 4:00 straight up, and thanks everybody for being timely. Looking at our agenda, Brandon and I both agree that it can be termed busy, so we have a lot of things. So we're starting right on time, and we're going to try to stick to the schedule as we go through it. So we're opening the meeting of the Ashland Housing and Human Services Commission. And the first thing we're going to look at is the approval of the minutes.
So move.
There's been motion to approve the minutes. Heidi, you want to make your...
there's just one typo, and it's an annual update to the City Council on the first page. And instead of Aaron Crowley, it says Eric.
Oh, okay.
So, simple.
So it's kind of traditional that we get these things out right at the beginning, and Heidi's always got our back for that.
So to be adopted is corrected.
And we have a motion to it, and was there a second?
Second.
All those in favor of accepting the minutes of the last meeting, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? We accomplish the minutes. So we're now to move to public forum. Now we have people here to speak for us for ORA. Do you want to? No. So we have no public speaking at the public forum. So let us move directly to the winter shelter update and let our three guests come up. And we're going to try to stick to 20 minutes.
20 minutes. We'll do it, Rich.
I'm sure there'll be questions and everything. So, but
so is it 20 minutes and questions?
Well, we're just going to see. Just roll and we'll see
Jackie,
how we all go.
Can you close that door? Okay.
Oh, so looks like that's Dennis's seat.
Oh, good. Oh, okay. Good. Never mind them.
Looks like that's Dennis's seat, so I'll pull it. Michelle, you sit there.
Hey. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Rich and Commission, for giving us the opportunity to give you an update on our winter shelter, which opens November 4th, and we are working at least 50 hours a week, if not more, to make this all happen. This got a little out of order. We were asked to come to the City Council and give a presentation on September the 17th. Normally, we would have come here first, so we apologize for that. We followed the Council's request. So we're coming to you afterwards. And we've got a little update from these slides. These are still the same slides we used then. Oh, I do. Yeah, Diane DeReese is here. Diane's one of our board members and is in charge of our resource development. So she is the gal that finds money for us.
Alrighty.
Oh, amen.
She has a whole group of people working on that, almost everybody on the board. But thank you, Diane. Just briefly, you all know this backwards and forwards, but this is last year's shelter. 12 community partners. I won't read through that list. You know who they are. I will point out at the bottom of that list, 5,200 volunteer hours, an average of something like 34 volunteer hours per night. It was from mid-November to mid-April, 154 nights. And I do want to name the four churches that stepped up when we lost Pioneer Hall, the Presbyterian Church, the United Methodist Church, the Trinity Episcopal Church, and the Rogue Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Without those four churches, we wouldn't have had it a place last year. We only had 36 beds, 34 of which could be used for guests and two for hosts. And keep that number in mind, 34 guest beds for the next slide. We also operated the city's extreme weather warming center on 11 nights, one in January and 10 in February. The one in January was at the Methodist Church. The 10 in February were at the one at Pioneer Hall and 9 at the Methodist Church. I'll just barge forward unless anybody's got any questions. These are the results from last year. 135 homeless were screened at our resource center with a vulnerability assessment. 99 of them were given shelter reservations. Remember, we had 34 beds, so 99 people got reservations for 34 beds, turnover. Some people stayed in their bed, pads on the floor, in their bed all winter long. Maybe, I don't know. We didn't count that, but I would imagine it was around 10, maybe more or less. You can see the demographics, 32 women, 67 men of the 99. 61% were chronic homeless by HUD's definition, homeless for more than 1 year with one disability or homeless 4 times in 4 years with one disability. They ranged in age from 18 to 77 years. Great story about the guy, 77, but I don't know if we'll have time for that. We found him home. 35 people were 50 years and over, 12 women and 23 men. And here's what we're proud of. 19 people found HUD-approved housing. This is not living in a camper with no hookups. This is HUD-approved housing, a bathroom, a kitchen, fresh water, heat, and electricity. 33 additional people filled out applications for subsidized housing. If they'll stick with us, we will house some of those people. A 45 secured Oregon health plan, health insurance, and you can see the rest of the numbers there. We think for our first year, we're pleased with that. So,
I just had a question about the 19 with the found housing. Do you know what percentage or what number were in Ashland versus other areas?
I do not know, Rich.
I was just curious. But we don't have as much, and sometimes people find it.
It's a good question, because we're obligated with the funding we got from the state through Access to provide a shelter for anybody in Jackson County. But the vast majority of the people we housed were here locally because they have the Kelly Shelter in Bedford that handled the northern county people. But I don't know that number. So, if you look at Aura's annual results, and if you look down the column on the extreme left, the winter shelter, we had 19 housed who were unhoused. We had 99 individuals with temporary housing. A shelter is a temporary house. You can see our job match program. We didn't keep accurate enough statistics on job match, so these actually might be a little conservative in the shelter. We might have found more than that. We'll do a better job of that this year. You can see the temporary jobs and the permanent jobs and the total number of other essential services provided. If you combine that with the resource center, the community resource center, you can see we found homes for 61 families total last year. 129 evictions prevented. I don't need to read the rest of that. You can see it. I think what the shelter did is allow Aura to really begin serving the entire homeless population. We've always served the homeless population with the resource center, but we haven't seen as many chronic homeless in the resource center, and they're a much more difficult population to serve. So it was a good move for us to get involved with the shelter, and we think it was a good move for our community as well. And Michelle, who's working the 50 hours a week, will talk about this year's shelter.
Well, first of all, I'm really excited to announce that we did find our winter shelter director, our shelter director, and it was quite a lengthy process in interviews and narrowing it down and making offers and not quite just getting the person in there. And now, just I was just sharing with Diane, and all of our shelter meetings this week, I just keep seeing how she's such the right fit for this position. And her name is Cass Sinclair, and she starts on Monday. And so we're all very excited about that. And she knows she's going to start on a treadmill running and continuing to you know, do all she can for the shelter. And the other piece is, you know, really this program is a hybrid program. It's Aura and it's the volunteers. It's we are working closely together. We have steering committee meetings every single week, and we really work to bring in that rich, wonderful heart and dedication and structure that the volunteers put in place, and then continue to add a foundational piece when it comes to the shelter. And a lot of what Ken talked about is what Aura is all about is working with our guests to move from crisis to stability. And those wraparound services with our case management and our navigators really makes all the difference. And so instead of, feeding people, we're teaching them to fish and working with them where they're at to help those building blocks. And for them to be able to even think about the next step, it's kind of hard to think about anything until you know that you have a warm bed to sleep at night and shelter over your head. And once you have that, you can kind of start ticking away at the other areas to move yourself to stability. And so that's, I think, a big piece about Aura. So the permit is secured. You know, that was a wild ride. Kelly Matting was phenomenal in helping us get that permit with the county. That was quite a lengthy process. Ken was pretty amazing and holding the tail of that bucking bronco and really, you know, came together and got the permit. And so everybody's so incredibly excited that we're at one location this year, which is going to make all the difference in the world. We have a 3-year permit. The shelter is opening November 4th, goes through the end of March. The max capacity is the 49 beds, 45 beds for guests and 4 for hosts. 2 of our seasoned hosts and then 2 hosts in training is our philosophy around that. We will have a full-time director and a navigator. Like I mentioned, we have the steering committee, and then we have the shelter sponsors, which are a lot of those faith-based organizations that you saw on the first slide, have stepped up again and are sponsoring a night and working to get night hosts, and we'll have food in the evening and food in the morning for our guests and check in people and check out people, and just, again, amazing community stepping up to support the shelter. The funding for our shelter, our budget is right around $267,000. There's really no fluff in that budget. It covers facility expenses, our shelter director, navigator, and overhead. And right now, the funding that we have for the shelter is the $150,000, which we are grateful for, which is pass-through funding through Access. And it was, we were hoping to get a little more, but I know that that pie was a little bit smaller this year, so all the organizations that they supported, they weren't able to increase the funding. So what we're looking at fiscally for Aura as a whole is we are still raising dollars for the Resource Center. We are raising over $100,000 for the winter shelter, and we have been out talking with people quite a bit over these past few months and really putting out there, you know, it takes a village. It really takes a village to help this population, and what we are looking for is people to help us find this funding so we can continue to serve at a deep level. And one of the things, and I think it's sometimes hard to imagine what our guests go through day in and day out. You know, if we didn't have a bed to sleep in, if we didn't have food in our stomachs, how would we be able to operate? You know, and so once we can provide just the basics, then it really helps them move to those next areas that help stabilize them and move to a place of finding housing. It's just makes all the difference in the world. And so one of the things, and Ken's going to talk about this a little bit more, but we did, Senator Jeff Golden has been amazing. He came out and toured the site and just was wowed by having the one location, by all the volunteers that support it, by the numbers that we're able to serve. And has said he's going to come stay the night, one of the winter shelter nights, which would be amazing. But got his chief of staff out there rallying to find funds for us. And she's been connecting us to different partners. And so we're planting a lot of seeds right now, planting a lot of seeds to sustain the shelter. And what's wonderful, the last thing I'll say about Aura is we have the Resource Center, the laundry shower trailer, and the winter shelter. And it's wraparound services. So each of the guests usually are touched in one of those locations, and we can continue to serve them even once the shelter is closed and help them find housing or that next step for them. So it really is year-round. And the board is phenomenal, and I can't say enough about the community. I've worked in a lot of communities, and for how small Ashland is, such huge heart here and so many dedicated people serving that population that is most in need.
I want to say a word about the funding, because this concerns us greatly. We've never been in this sort of box before. We've grown as our funding has grown, but when we took on the shelter last year, we more than doubled in size. And now we have serious deficits staring us in the face. Diane and Michelle and people from the resource development team have looked at all doors to knock on. We're knocking on the state with Jeff Golden and Pam Marsh. They've both been to the shelter, all the way down to the individual charitable donor. And we have plans for all of those. And I'd like to talk about the city's plan. And we had a lot of discussions about this at our board meeting on Tuesday night, and I'd like to follow my notes here. I'll make it quick, but I don't want to leave anything out. We all remember the spring and summer of last year, 2018, when the city was questioning the viability of Pioneer Hall for the winter shelter program. Aura was a part of those discussions, and the deeper we got into potential solutions, the louder we heard the city ask us to take on all operating responsibilities for the shelter. At that time, the work of the volunteer shelter was admirable. It was laudable. It met the immediate need of providing people with a warm, dry, safe place for cold winter nights. But Aura's mission was more long-term. Our mission statement is to put people on a path toward self-sufficiency. And so our board was reluctant early on to get involved. Later in the summer, Aura received a grant from the state through Access, which allowed for wraparound case management. And that kind of sealed the deal for us. This overcame our primary concern, and Aura's board, I won't say reluctantly, but with some anxiety, voted to take on responsibility for Ashland's winter shelter program. So how did we do? If I can be allowed to brag for just a moment, last year, with less than a handful of paid professionals, combined with faith communities, nonprofits, and a couple hundred volunteers, we provided not only a warm, dry, safe place during cold winter nights for Ashland's most vulnerable, but at the same time, we found housing for 19 of them, jobs for 17 of them, health insurance for 45 of them, and numerous other essential services. We feel that we can honestly say that we put many of our homeless on a path toward from crisis toward stability. The city staff has been just extremely responsive in helping Aura secure the county permit for operate this year's shelter. However, in the last week, we've seen the headlines, news articles of $950,000 dedicated to a dog park, $2.6 million that the city's going to pursue for a city pool. We love our city. We love its amenities. I personally use the dog park. And when my grandkids over, they want to go to the swimming pool or to Garfield's water park. But Aura is at the level where it needs additional support for the homeless in this community. And so now we are asking the city to significantly, and I want to underline the word significantly, support the fiscal needs of the Ashland community winter shelter. We do that for, we think there are five reasons the city should be supporting the Ashland Winter Shelter Program. Number one, the Winter Shelter Program explicitly assists the city in meeting its own current biennial goal, a tier two goal, quote, an urgency to assist the homeless, quote. Number two, thanks to the volunteers involved in the Ashland Winter Shelter, it's extremely cost-effective temporary housing. Right now, we're looking at $38 per bed per night. $38 per bed per night. Jeff Golden brought in an expert on housing from Portland with the Myers Memorial Trust. She said that's an extremely cost-effective number. We can do that because of volunteers. And this meets another of the city's Tier 2 goals, quote, an urgency to address housing needs. This is addressing housing needs. It's temporary housing. Number three, the Ashland Winter Shelter Program not only provides a warm, dry, safe place for our most vulnerable residents, but has a proven track record of finding housing, employment, and essential services for many of our chronic homes. Number four, the Winter Shelter Program is enthusiastically supported throughout the city by its citizens, its faith communities, and several nonprofits. This is a community project. And number five, in all instances that we're aware of, let us know if there's something that you see differently. In all instances that we're aware of, the local city agency has been a significant fiscal supporter of its local shelter. We put the fifth one in because we've heard feedback that county a shelter is primarily a county's responsibility, and indeed we're getting 60% of our support through Access from state, but in all the shelters we're aware of, local city shelters, the city is a big time fiscal supporter. So we come to you Not so much with hat in hand asking for support, but more it was an agreement up front that if we take this over, the city will support us. We took it over. We did the job. We're expecting the city to support us.
So let's get questions on the table, folks. So we got 10 minutes to discuss it.
It's just something that just sort of maybe a statement, but of where the Aura shelter fits within Oregon right now in the state of Oregon, that we have a declared crisis of homelessness in our state, and I think it's so important for us to keep that in mind, because I think we're just seeing the beginning of what we have in terms of chronic homelessness. So that is in my mind of where this fits in with our community.
I had a question. Your number five, your fifth comment that you made, I believe you said that the city, I wanted to be very clear, the kind of like a partnership. The city gave you this, to partner with the city to continue this so that we don't drop the ball on it. Your fifth statement that you made, is it like a partnership, or what's your
vision? I remember sitting in this room with city council. Mm-hmm. Jackie and Dennis were part of that in those days. And I remember last year feeling a pressure from the city and from the volunteers to get involved, Dora. And finally, when we got some case management support, we agreed to do it. But this is not something that we looked forward to taking on. There were members of our board that thought the magnitude of the winter shelter would dwarf the resource center, which has been very successful. And there was a lot of discussion about the danger of undoing what we've already done. So we got involved, and we got involved at the city's request. And so we feel like, I hate to use the word quid pro quo these days, but
it's getting bandied about a bit.
Bad words.
We feel like an agreement was there last year that if we got involved, the city would support us. And we are now $117,000 short on the shelter, and we're knocking on every door we can find. We need some help.
Okay.
So I just want to say from my perspective, what you've done is really up-level considerably what we were calling the shelter before. What we were doing in Pioneer Hall didn't have the case management. We weren't working with people to get everything that they needed, other than individual volunteers out of the goodness of their heart would take people to appointments and try to get that to happen. So I'm not sure with that, and I don't know that I can speak for the city, but I'm not sure the city understood that shifting it to being an agency that really is providing wraparound services is going to cost a lot more than what we were doing with, Band-Aids and, scotch tape. So it makes sense to me that it's going to cost more, and that we have some responsibility to honor that agreement. But I don't know that I thought through it that far then, but I see it. And you've explained it very well. It's going to cost more to do real services.
So I have a question for our board. I mean, from my perspective, for the last chameleon years, every meeting has had some focus on homeless issues. And so it is something that has been just a part of what we're doing, and now we're getting ready to make a next step. And when Aura is saying they're approaching the city, we are the city, mm-hmm. we're part of it, and we have an advisory role. So my only thought about the dollars is that it may be just semantic, but I would like to see sustainable dollars rather than emergency dollars. I know the city will, if they look at it, would say, oh, we can pull here and there. But I think that then we're going to be coming back next year, and that, that there is a role for the city to play here, and that is a sustainable role. It's a hard one. We know because we had to claw out the money for the housing trust fund. But, you know, as was pointed out, there's money coming out in other places, and that we could be a help in looking at that, but they've never really taken our advice on finding money, really. But I, the question is, do we want to play, to send an advisory note to the council saying that we support looking for sustainable dollars for this program?
Yeah.
There's one yes.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So now the next question is, how do we do it? Maybe we can bring Brandon in. What is, do you have, I mean, we've tried advisory memos before. Is that our best?
You know, I think consulting with the city administrator on how to bring it to the city council would probably be the first step. So she could determine when best to bring it forth. I know that you guys have done work in the past that I didn't work with you directly on, but identifying a variety of funding sources to support housing. I think some of that work probably could also be revisited and provided as potential funding streams to address what you're discussing in terms of a sustainable.
So weirdly enough, I'm meeting with Kelly Madding at 10:30 in the morning.
How convenient.
Weirdly enough, it's because we have our report coming to the council on the 4th, I think. And so I guess it was just getting ahead of that option. But can we craft a statement now for the minutes that sort of says something, what we're asking? I mean, so that it becomes official in the minutes.
Are you writing it down, Gina? Are you?
No, I'm making it.
I thought you were writing a resolution.
Yeah, I would think if the commission had a motion that you wanted to have incorporated in the minutes of this agenda item, and then that could be carried over and provided to the council, and you could relay that to Kelly when you speak tomorrow and ask her how to bring that forward to the council in a more formal way than just reading the minutes.
Right. Well, no, I wasn't thinking of so much. It just would be a little bit of a firmer place to stand on if, just besides we had the discussion, we wrote in the minutes that we felt like is sustainable funding sound like the right
word? Sustainable. We're going to be back again next year.
That's right.
And we're not telling them what it is. They're going to have to explore that. But that we, as a housing commission,
it's something like, after hearing a presentation from the ORA president and executive director, the Housing and Human Services Commission discussed and agreed upon a recommendation to the city council that they look for
sustainable funding for the winter shelter. Do we have all
in
that?
In order to honor the commitments that we made to ORA last year.
Thank you.
All right. So did that sort of come out, Liz?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so we'll take that as a motion from Jackie and a second from Linda. Okay, so any more discussion?
Well, the only thing is, I don't know that I would add the additional that honoring the commitments.
Yeah.
That's there. I mean, believe me, that's there because I was a part of it. Dennis was a part of it. But I don't want to try to push.
Box them in.
Right? Yeah. Well, but I agree with you.
You know, it's kind of weak saying, we heard a presentation and now we want to do this. I think you need to build it on the real
history
that we are now opening this shelter, and and Aura has done this, and I'm not trying to craft it, but that it is it we are talking about sustainable funding for this winter shelter, and we believe the city, because Aura took over the operation.
Or after examining the facts,
yes,
and history.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to get at with the presentation,
yeah,
that Aura has come to us and presented these facts and figures,
okay,
and that if that's included with the recommendation for a sustainable funding that goes forward, that's the impetus that is causing, I think, for us to say, we need to keep this up.
Well, I would just like to say that historically, providing winter shelter was more or less emergency shelter. We were so beyond our ability to sustain that prior to last year. We were having 50 to 70 people a night show up. We could not house them. When we lost the city building, we had no place to go. And it really felt like a Band-Aid. To me personally, I was like, how can we change this picture? We're like babysitting.
Yes.
We're not really solving problems. And that's been the amazing work that this past year has manifested through Aura. It's like a game changer.
Want to come with me?
Do I want to come with you?
Having that for a statement, something like that would be good.
So I have a hunch that it's going to come right back to us. Like, what are you doing with your block grant money? What are you doing with your housing trust fund money? And Linda's not here to answer those questions, but I think that we can also examine what resources we have that are unexpended that we can.
It'll be a process, mm-hmm, but this will be a step that we
can. May I say that we've talked to Linda a couple of times, several, mm-hmm, of us, and the Affordable Housing Trust Fund money is ripe for this use, and possibly some other, you have the three pots, social service, CDBG, Affordable Housing Trust Fund. If we're talking about some significant contribution by the city, what that's going to do is take those funds away from all the other needy,
correct,
nonprofits in,
right,
the city that need those funds.
Right.
It almost seems like a sustainable standalone carve-out.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That's where we're looking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I know Liz is typing away over there. In some ways, I think less exactly what we have in there is less than conveying the discussion tomorrow, but we should have something. Have you got something that's captured a bit of this?
Mm-hmm. I have Commissioners Jackie Bachman and Linda Rapond, motion and second, that after hearing the presentation from Aura and discussion, agreed to recommend to the City Council that sustainable funding be found for the winter shelter, is what I have right now.
Okay.
And the provision that I heard was that after examining Aura's facts and figures, mm-hmm, relating to the operation of the winter shelter, the HASC discussed and agreed to recommend the City Council identify a funding sustainable city funding source to support Aura and the ongoing success of the winter shelter.
Yeah, I think that captures it.
Okay. So I see an amen around here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I know that'll take some to get all put together, but rather than wordsmithing, if I see, let me just say, if there's no other discussion, all those in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstention? Looks like it was unanimous. So, I think we're ready to go, and it'll be on our agenda, and I know it'll be on your agenda for as you guys are going to be carrying the ball.
But
we maybe added a little bit of support for that.
Thank you for your support.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for this presentation.
Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're not totally out of whack time-wise. We can get on it. So our next point on the agenda is a seat presentation from Stu Green. Great. That's going to be interesting to hear that.
Principal function is to walk this document around, both within the city and to the community, to try to help folks understand our community and municipal commitments to the climate plan. And I can tell you more about that. Let's pass a few of these around. If you don't want to keep any of the handouts, you can just give them back to Brandon and I'll to somebody else. But real quick, raise your hand if you feel like you know something about it. Okay. So
I've read it.
A few people. So this is good. I just like to kind of gauge where we're at, because some of the groups I talk to have read it cover to cover. And, there's really a lot that, in the climate plan
that's shared with me.
Extremely thorough for a community of our size.
Yes.
We put a lot of thought into it when we were writing it. So I was on the initial ad hoc committee back in 2015, that helped write the plan. And at the time, we had said, you know, it's going to be really important that we have a permanent staff person helping to walk this around. And at the time, I thought, that's going to be a terrible job. but here I am. So I guess all odds thought that it sounded like a good challenge. And it is a big challenge. You can make no mistake. So I'm going to blast through some of this information here because we don't have a lot of time. I'm going to try to. When would you like me to be done, Brandon?
Rich.
How many other chairs? How much time would you like me to spend on this here today?
Well,
I know we're a little behind.
You were going to. The next one was scheduled at 4:55, it was 25 minutes, but I think just take the 25 or 23 now, okay. And go ahead.
Sounds good. So, you know, when we initially put together the climate plan, the first thing that the community typically does is say, well, what's the future that we want to create? Because without an idea of where we're trying to get to, of course, it's going to be much more difficult. And this was the output of that groupthink. Which was also based on a lot of community engagement. We did several open houses. This is sort of the distillation of the community intention. We want it to be a resilient community, meaning we can bounce back from natural disasters or other types of disasters, that we have zero or close to zero greenhouse gas emissions, which I would typically like to call climate pollution because it's maybe a little more visceral. We would like to be a more equitable community. I think there's probably a pretty good understanding in this group about certain inequities that exist. And we also don't want to forget that the principal reason we want to have a climate plan is to help ensure a healthy future for our youngsters. I'm sorry, it's a little bit small. I don't typically like to do texty slides, but when I'm trying to present the climate plan, there's inevitably a bunch of text. So forgive me, please. Well, you know, a lot of folks will ask me, like, I don't want to read the plan. Just tell me, like, what do we need to do? Like, big picture. So here it is, right up front. We need to have decarbonized renewable energy for our whole utility system, not just our electric, but also our natural gas or any other form of energy that we may choose to tap into in the future. For buildings, the current science is saying we need to electrify aggressively. The reason is because natural gas has all sorts of ancillary emissions that we don't track at the point of use. And it's also, for air quality, typically electric fuel is better. kind of goes without saying in this part of the country that we don't want coal, that there's not a lot of coal here, not locally anyway. Transportation, electrify, again, shifting away from fossils. This is something you've all heard, I'm sure. But also to diversify transportation. So many projects go in front of, in front of council or in front of the community planners or in front of the developers, and it's assumed that in many ways we will continue development as normal. I think a lot of people are starting to understand that there's more of a need for intermodal transportation. Cars are not the thing, and I think private car ownership is going to die a slow death in this country, especially in a rural area like here. I guarantee you that within 10 years, you'll be able to have an app on your phone where you can have some sort of self-driving pod will pick you up and take you where you need to go. And that'll probably cost 20% of owning a car. So for a lot of people, it won't really be a choice. It'll be a necessity. But that has a lot of good benefits, too. Like, we don't need as much parking. Or self-driving cars mean that parking can happen somewhere else, not right in front of our business. This is kind of big picture, far away stuff. Not going to see it tomorrow, but climate plan is looking really far out. So.
And you're saying that's within 10 years?
I'm saying that's within 10 years for big metro areas. For Ashland, who knows? We took a little while to get Uber and things like that, and those services still don't work quite the same way here as they do in bigger places. So we're definitely a special application here, not only for our sort of geographic island feature, but also because we have so much tourism and people do travel here. So we'll need a diversity of transport for that. Consumption, if you guys look at the pie chart on your handout, the dark blue wedges are what we typically call consumption. That's all the goods and services that you buy. Those have emissions that occur outside of the city limits, but they're emissions that we need to consider. If we exist only on lamb imported from Scotland, it's going to be a very high carbon diet. But if we grow our own corn in the backyard, that looks a little different. So just taking an eye at where do we get our goods and services and how are they produced is a really big piece of the pie, so to speak. So here's one more thing.
You have a question?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I have a question about where our electricity comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I owned a house in Portland with Blue Sky programs, you had a choice of what kind of electricity you bought, where it was sourced from.
Correct.
Since Ashland owns the utility here, our rates are much higher here, and I realize I don't really know what the source of our electricity is.
Sure. Our rates are actually on parity with the Pacific Power, in most cases a little bit less, but what you see in the mail drives me nuts. It says electric bill on it,
mm-hmm.
and that's all your city service bills.
Yeah.
And so I would say if you actually look at the electric portion, it's probably pretty close to what your neighbors in town are paying. We pay different types of fees to the state and to the utility.
We have a 25% utility tax, right? So that's
right.
One of the huge pieces that nobody else has.
Right.
But to answer your question, we purchase our power from Bonneville Power Administration, which is 90% hydropower. They fill in with wind and nuclear for the rest, and that's a shift. And any moment, it may be a slightly different mix. The other thing, so I'm an engineer by training, and I sometimes will go too far down the technical rabbit hole, but the energy that we take out, or the power that we take out of the outlet, it's often compared to water in a pipe. That's not really how it works. I mean, it's oscillating electrons. So that's bouncing energy from the whole unified grid to us. And it's not really possible to say, like, what color is the electron. But what we can do is look at the regional average of carbon intensity. And that's, Pacific Power is the highest. PGE is less. The regional average is somewhere in the middle. If you look at the carbon intensity of the stuff we actually buy from BPA, it's way down. It's mostly hydro. And so depending on how you ask the question, you'll get a different answer. Like, what's the carbon intensity of the energy we buy is one answer. What's the carbon intensity of the regional average is a different answer. And they're both useful questions, but it can be really confusing.
Does the city of Ashland have the option of choosing what proportion is comes from which sources?
No, we don't. So the way the Blue Skies program works is that Pacific Power will purchase renewable energy certificates on your behalf. We could layer a voluntary rate tier on top of our system to do the same thing, and that's in fact been proposed. The new Climate Policy Commission that's just coming online is going to be looking at that. But there's a pretty big contingent of folks who say, hey, that's a great idea, we should have renewable energy certificates, but isn't it better to take that same funding and just use it to do local projects? Like, what's the value in having it, being able to say in a legally forthwith way that you are renewable, right? That's what you buy with that certificate.
Have you done cost comparisons and looked at which mode you would recommend in terms of whether it would really be beneficial to allow an overlay of people purchasing renewable?
Yeah, that's the commission will be addressing that. That's something that I could decide, you know, on my own and put forth as a policy, but I think it would be much better to go through the commission process and have folks say what they think they want those funds set aside for. You know, creating a voluntary rate tier is very easy, but to understand what people want that money spent on and how many people will voluntarily opt in is important to get a handle on. Great. I'm going to keep on going. Let me just say before I go further, though, that if y'all have questions at any time, you can email me and my thing will be on here at the end. So we have two main goals, and this is in your handout. For the climate plan. There's kind of overall goals, and then there are different sector or focus areas that have their own little sub-goals. But the big mama-papa goal is minus 8% greenhouse gas emissions on average every year for the whole community. That's immense. It's a very aspirational goal. We have already pretty much missed it. That doesn't mean it's a bad goal. But particularly the way this graph was drawn, it's a little misleading. This was just to show the intent of the policy. This says 2015, things started to take a dive. Well, in fact, 2015 is when we published this plan, before it had even been adopted. So really, if we had successful policies that created this type of change, we wouldn't see it start until 2018. But I'm here to tell you also that we haven't been able to, as a community, make that much change in that short amount of time.
Is there a percentage of change we have made?
You know, it's really tough to say, and I don't feel like if I gave you a number that I could confidently say that this is the number. And the reason is because a lot of this pie chart on the front is based on some medium certainty data. So that's stuff that if we make the best policy ever and implement it immediately, the model that we use to predict these numbers may not show any change. So we use the inventory as a directional tool to say, hey, what kinds of policies do we need to think about? Not so much as like a speedometer saying, here's exactly how much we've done. Because it's a very, you know, climate is a very like meta topic. Like our emissions happen here, they happen over there, they happen in China, they happen all the little bits and pieces of this thing that got made. So it's really tough to like say with specificity a lot of things. But we don't need, you know, we don't need a micrometer to measure something that we're going to cut with an axe. Like, that's what we need to do. you guys already have this. I just have this in case people don't have the handout. This is a slightly different rendition, but it shows you very well that consumption, building energy use, and transportation are the big sources of emissions. So second half of the first goal is for the city only. For the 8% was for the whole community. This is just for City of Ashland operations. So we're saying 2030 we want to be carbon neutral. And that could involve buying some kind of carbon offsets or doing some sort of make good policy, because probably we're not going to be able to completely eliminate carbon fuels in that amount of time. But plus all living organisms emit carbon. So like to say total zero is not, I think, accurate, but to say we're neutral or that we are sort of emitting some but sequestering some or compensating some.
So one day, a week ago or so, I was driving to an appointment,
and I passed three different city vehicles.
Yes.
One was the electric department, one was the water treatment department, and one was, I don't know if it was the dam, or it had, they were labeled. And I'm just wondering, so are those electric vehicles? Are we working on that? Because,
yes.
Okay.
We are working on that.
Okay.
Right now, the thing that's most cost-effective is passenger vehicle replacement. We have a really good fleet guy, and he's very supportive of that. We made an admin policy that said you shall replace with a non-fossil vehicle if it exists and is, you know, affordable. So now that means passenger vehicles.
And they actually were passenger vehicles that I was seeing,
There's not going to be any electric dump trucks or fire trucks anytime soon.
Right, I didn't expect that.
However, we do have two new electric utility bucket trucks where the bucket part is electric.
Oh, okay.
So they don't have to leave the car running while they're up there on the lines. It's actually better for worker safety, less emissions. It's,
cool.
It's been good so far.
Good, I feel better.
So we're looking at cutting fossil use in half by 2030. I think that's achievable, and 100% by 2050. So, okay, so that's goal number one, which is actually two parts. Goal number two is, you know, in my opinion, this didn't get well represented in the actual plan document, in part because we ran out of time as a committee, but also it's much more amorphous, harder to measure. Sometimes when you're doing, it's called adaptation to climate change, you actually have to emit carbon in order to adapt, like national forest resiliency. We're burning, but it's a good burn. So it's, you know, you don't want to think necessarily just in terms of carbon reduction, that's it forever. Sometimes we need to do things, especially where this is preparing our community. This is kind of the way I like to think about it. And what's going to happen in Ashland? It's going to get hotter, it's going to be drier, it might be colder even. Sometimes we could have a repeat of the flood. We have a dam right upstream of us that could crack in an earthquake. So, I mean, there's all kinds of things we could do to get ready. Not all of those examples I just gave are climate-related, but climate touches all those things in some way. And this is a big, you know, I think adaptation to climate change is in some ways more relevant to all the people who live in our community because it affects them directly. You know, if there's a smoky day, who in Ashland is not affected by it?
Right.
Everybody's affected by it. But if I say, you know, it doesn't matter whether you believe in climate change to be affected by these climate impacts. So sometimes if you have a community meeting, you know, framing it as this, like, dealing with impacts, you'll get more people to the table, in my opinion. But a lot of our climate plans talk about reducing carbon, you know, electric vehicles, LEDs, and that's all great. But there's a whole other piece of it, which I think you folks would appreciate because it touches the vulnerable populations more. Okay, I'm going to have a drink while you folks read this slide. Sorry, I'm talking fast.
So like 10 minutes, is that
no good? Problem. So as I mentioned, there are six focus areas in the climate plan. There's buildings and energy, there's urban form, land use and transportation, consumption and materials, natural systems, public health, safety, and well-being, and what I call communication. And this, I just pulled out a couple of these to show you because I don't want to, you know, spend all the whole time talking about what's in the plan. But this is strategies for efficient buildings and renewable energy. Now, why does this matter? Because you folks deal with housing, I think. There's a couple of things I have to say about housing, which some people love and some people hate, but I'll just tell you how I feel. This one here, encourage increased building energy efficiency, that's a pretty big one. I mean, we've been working on energy efficiency since the 70s and fuel crisis, and we still have tons of work to do. So why is that? It's because people don't really like talking about energy efficiency. It's boring. You can't see it. It's not sexy. Whatever the reason is, but there's so much room to reduce waste in this country. Food waste, energy waste, construction waste, demolition waste, I mean, everything. So, let's see. I think this is these first two are the main ones that I want to say, like, are relevant to this group, maybe. And then I'll show you, inside of this focus area called buildings and energy, there are a bunch of different actions that have been identified. Sorry for the text again, but here are five actions that I pulled out of the plan. They're, I think, mostly in chronological order, but they're from different sections of the plan. So one is, how do we increase participation in these energy efficiency incentives that we offer? That's a nice benefit of being a BPA customer, is that they give us money that's free, you know, not attached to the rest of our city budget, that we can spend on energy efficiency. So if you have Dan come to your home and do an energy efficiency audit, has anybody done that? Oh, you guys should all get on Dan's list. So you should call Dan and have him come. He'll come to your house, poke around, and give you a list of ideas for what you can do to save energy in your home. And he'll also tell you, hey, we have incentive programs for windows or for lights or for, you know, whatever works for your house. And that's a service that is paid for in part by the fact that we buy from BPA. So we have these nice programs. We want to get them out there more. There's probably more opportunity for him to do that kind of work than we have staff capacity for. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't call him. So here's an idea that has been kicked around. Maybe you haven't thought about it. But what if we require building energy scores for all residential buildings? That way, if you buy a building or you rent a building or an apartment, you know up front, like, how does this rank on the scale of red to green? Sounds like a great idea. Portland has done that. By the time of sale, you have to register to get a score. It's gone actually pretty well. There's been a bunch of speed bumps on the way. But there's always a hitch, right? What's the hitch is that we don't have raters in this area who can do that service. So we would, if we wanted to have a policy like that, we'd have to figure out, well, how do we, you know, increase the pool of people who can provide the service we're mandating? Or do we just offer it as we're going to cover it for a few years because we're at the city and we're nice? And we're asking you to do this, so we'll cover it. Yeah.
So I have a question. I'm looking at number three up there, third dot.
Yeah.
And manufactured housing, mm-hmm. and where that fits in. I mean, for some Ashlanders, that's a horrible concept. But for others, it's a great concept in my opinion. But we have all these different little parks that are buried in the neighborhoods. Is there any look at the city working with organizations to buy those parks and, you know, clean them out and then put in new manufactured housing that would be affordable housing and would be energy efficient?
I might
any discussions like that
guy.
Going on?
I know that there is state funds available for manufactured home parks to collaboratively get together and work to buy the park for the tenants
right.
to become owners.
Right.
But there hasn't been a city initiative to use city funds to go out and acquire city parks or mobile home parks.
Does the city have a positive attitude towards the concept of manufactured housing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's yeah. one of the
okay.
identified needed
Good.
Housing types. We just amended the okay. Housing element to
yeah.
eliminate a lot of the negative terminology about manufactured
yeah.
housing that was in it.
Yeah,
so.
That's and I know yeah. that's good. But I'm also now looking for reality. Is there anything making progress towards? Yeah. I mean, I always hear the cottages.
I just say that Pam Marsh is leading
yeah.
kind of both the local and state work on manufactured
yes.
housing, and there's a whole bunch of a new legislation that's passed, a new that proposed that's trying to get there.
Is it trickling down though to Ashland? Do you think? I mean,
they haven't figured out the factor that really they're privately owned spaces, and
yeah.
you're really just kind of picking at the edges, and unless you really address the fact that the private owners of the parks are really the in control. But I think they're trying to do an educational approach to all of that. And so
thank you for changing it in the housing element.
Well, thank you guys.
Yeah, I know. Wait, okay, go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. I'm going to probably skip a couple slides here just to wrap it up. But, you know, these are two things. I think these are identified actions in the climate plan of developing efficiency standards or finding ways to reduce barriers in multifamily or rental properties. And that's, you know, a huge subject, first of all. I think the split incentive of landlords and renters has been pretty well established. There are some pretty novel ways to try to get around that. I guess the questions are, how do we want to do that here, and what kind of resources do we have to do that here? You know, it's a matter of prioritization, I suppose. So when I talk to people actually about their homes, they're like, tell me what I need to do in my house. Like, that's all. Just tell me what to do. And so I thought about it for a while, and this is kind of how it boils down. Not in any particular order, although this order does make sense for a couple of reasons. Be ready for emergencies. Like, it costs you $0 to put a bunch of water in your basement or garage or under your bed or whatever. And, you know, a box of ramen is $5. So if there's an earthquake, you'll be glad you have a box of ramen, even if you don't eat ramen. So my point, though, is that it's cheap, it's easy, everyone can do it. There's really no reason not to do it. Being efficient, I mentioned we have Dan and Larry, really good resources. There's a lot of information online about how you get more efficient and how you can use less energy. And electrifying everything is a really big tenet of how do we reduce emissions. It also happens to be that we have our own utility, so it's good for business if we're also getting people to electrify. I don't like to lead with that because that's not the goal. But the fact is we do have our utility, and we can leverage that in a variety of ways that Pacific Power customers can't. And then renewable energy is super important, but a lot of times this can come last, depending on what your resources are. So let me scoot ahead here. Here's, I think, a couple of questions that I think are worth dropping on the group. I don't have answers to these, but I think if any of you want to grapple with these or have a conversation about it, like, I'm here to be conversed with. So how can we enable renters and property owners to invest in energy upgrades? You know, long-standing question. How do we make new housing that is actually efficient and affordable and can somehow leverage renewable energy? Can we keep in touch with our vulnerable and underrepresented populations? If there's a fire, can we, you know, are the homeless people on Mixel? They'll probably get the message, but not if they're sleeping up in the park somewhere. So, you know, what about day laborers? Do they have Mixel?
We've actually done presentations to the homeless in this town at the Peace Meals on how to use Mixel and how to get it on their phones. Most of them have phones.
I believe it, yeah. And then lastly, you know, how do we develop housing to improve and support other modes of transportation?
You know, I saw something in the paper, maybe y'all saw it a couple of days ago, about the new cottages that they're building.
Yeah, and with they the have electric cars for the neighborhood. Yes.
I thought that was like a little step forward.
That was awesome.
The other thing that I'd like to say is, at least when we've talked to people about what is a vision for affordable housing, if we're creating affordable housing, and the support for green affordable housing is really strong. And so I don't think we want to assume that there's a barrier there. I think we can actually build more affordable housing with a green approach.
Yes.
Habitat for Humanity, what impressed me about them is they really work on the window seals. And, I mean, they have a green focus from what I can see that's been very helpful. It just, we can't seem to help them get in enough. It's too hard to get them in to build. But
a lot of times with housing, it's, you know, you pay now or you pay later.
Yeah.
So putting it a little more up front, build a quality envelope, you'll have a much more affordable house to operate. Okay, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, very good. Awesome. Right
let
on
Brandon
time.
Know if you have other questions, or you can email me as you like.
Is there?
I want to keep it.
What is the email in here?
It'll be on the slides that I'll send for
right
you guys.
Right there.
To have.
See that
and
there?
There it is. Yeah, here's that. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Sue, very much. Very timely. So now we're going to go to Brandon, who's got the...
We're being heavy on PowerPoint presentations.
Yeah.
So what I'm presenting on tonight is a buildable lands inventory, which the last time that the Housing Commission saw it was in 2011. So a lot of you, Housing and Human Services Commission, wasn't formed yet at that point in time. So some of you are familiar with what a buildable lands inventory is, but for those that are not, this presentation is for. Essentially, the BLI is a support document to the urbanization element of the comprehensive plan. It's a technical assessment document, doesn't contain any policy recommendations or strategies for housing. The purpose of the document is really to create the point in time of what is our available buildable land today, create a database that is intended to identify lands that are available for future development, and it ultimately quantifies the amount of vacant and partially vacant land that's available within the political boundaries of the city of Ashland, and that's both the city limits and the urban growth boundary. Ultimately, in combination with the housing needs analysis, which is a separate document that you're familiar with, and an economic opportunities analysis for the commercial side, they allow the city to determine whether or not there exists an adequate supply of land, supply of buildable land to accommodate the future housing and business development within the city. So the, in order to undertake this, we had to do an assessment of every property within the city and the urban growth boundary, and evaluate the specific development potential of each lot, looking at existing buildings as well as physical constraints to development. And for all those properties that were deemed either partially vacant or wholly vacant, looked at those constraints on using a spatial analysis tool through the geographic information systems to really quantify how much of that lot's land area was in floodplains or steep slopes, greater than 25% or otherwise unbuildable. And so, but another important part to note is just because a portion of a lot might be in a floodplain and that portion is unbuildable, our land use ordinances allow the transfer of housing density out of that floodplain onto the remaining portion of the property. And so we had to do an adjustment in terms of how much housing capacity there was on the remaining lots. The result of all that effort is a map which is far too detailed in the GIS system. I have some close-ups to show you in a second. But the data sources used were the city's geographic information systems, Jackson County's tax lot database, and assessor's data. And we pulled every building permit that had been issued since the completion of the last buildable lands inventory, and mapped all of those building permits in order to zoom in on those properties that were developed in that period of time. And fortunately, we had 2018 aerial photographs that were taken, so we could, you know, verify without going out to every individual lot to see what had been built on those properties that were identified. And lastly, the 2011 buildable lands inventory provided the framework for the document. So I wanted to describe a little bit of the BLI classifications by showing this area in the, I guess it would be the northwest side of town. So this is up here is Quiet Village area. This is North Main Street. I think Breadboard is located right there, just to orient you. So the partially vacant means the lot is big enough to have further development potential on it. So in the case of looking at some of these residential lots over off of Otis and Willow, you can see that they're large lots relative to a lot of the small... I'm not getting a mouse here. Let me turn on a pen. So it's not showing either.
It's showing the screen.
Okay. Well, nonetheless, the blue lots in the lower right-hand corner, those are single-family homes on larger lots. They have additional development potential. We want to capture that in the BLI, so we call that partially vacant. The big red lot is a vacant property today. There is a land use application to subdivide that into a single-family subdivision with two cottage housing developments within it that's currently being processed through the Planning Commission. But as of the date that we pulled this data, that property is vacant. And so we wanted to include such vacant properties. The green areas are either private open space or public parks. Off of North Main Street, you can see both in the left-hand side. Next to Grant Street, that's open space associated with a private development, so it's not public property, but even though that tax lot is vacant, it can't be developed, so we want to exclude it. The same with the one right below that, that's Scenic Park, which is a park. So then we also have parking lots that are, they're technically vacant, but that parking lot is needed for associated development nearby or if it's a public parking lot. So those are some of the classifications. We also looked at SOU and undevelopable properties on the steep hillsides, for instance. The reason I'm showing this slide is I wanted to show you a lot of small blue lots within historic districts. So we may go through the railroad district or up off of Allison behind the library and see those lots as fully developed. They're not. They built out of single-family home properties, but they're multifamily zoned, so there's a lot of opportunity for additional units to be located in people's backyards or side yards because the lots are large enough for multiple units. And there's, as you can see, very few red lots fully vacant in the core of the city. When we move out of the city, this is the normal neighborhood south of East Main, north of the railroad tracks. Between the middle school is on the far left and Clay Street. So you can see that large area, you know, interestingly, where Aura is located, kind of right in the center of that, where that number 50 is. There's 50-unit development potential on that. Right. So I wanted to show this tax lot-based map. Normal neighborhood additively has 450-unit potential because it is largely vacant or partially vacant. Even those lots with existing homes on it can have considerably more given the underlying zoning once it comes into the city. And the lower right-hand side, the two red lots right there, is where the new Housing Authority of Jackson County development is proposed and received approval from the Planning Commission and City Council upon appeal. And that was not appealed to LUBA, so that project can go forward. I wanted to point out this one because of the method by doing a buildable lands inventory. We have to look at, well, what's the base density? It allows for 13.5 units per acre, and I'm going to get into numbers here. So the lot is 3 1/3 acres, these two lots combined. That calculates they could do 45 dwelling units on that property. In the case of the Housing Authority, they use density bonuses to increase that to a total of 60 units. So even though the housing or the buildable lands inventory may provide a base number of housing units that could be accomplished on single-family lots or multifamily lots throughout the city and commercial properties, it's a conservative estimate because through density bonuses, more open space, property owners who do smaller units, they count for less density. All of these scenarios are like cottage housing will increase the number of units above these base limits. I won't go into the individual tables. They're in your document, and I can take questions on those because it does try and quantify the available acreage both on zoning, comprehensive plan designation, both from what in the city limits alone and the urban growth boundary.
I'm seeing that 1,161 gross acres.
Yeah.
Seems like a lot.
And I'm not showing the net acres, which I think is closer to 667. So when we take out steep slopes, the portion of those partially vacant properties where the front half is developed but the back half isn't, the full acreage of that property would be the gross acreage. So okay.
733.
Yeah, 733.
Yeah, so we do a reduction in order to kind of get a net buildable acres for calculations. Let's see. And so in addition to these tables about acreages, we did try and convert that in the document to, with those base densities per zone, the number of housing units that would likely be, could be created under those existing zonings. And this table shows that number of housing units that could be created. If I could focus on the far left here, the commercial, downtown employment districts, those numbers are deflated considerably. And the reason they are is because we built into both the 2005, 2011, and now the 2019 buildable lands inventory a 50% reduction in the number of residential units that would be accommodated in commercial properties. For instance, this property where we're sitting now, downtown zoned, 60 units per acre, there are absolutely zero housing units above it. And so because housing isn't required for commercial developments, although if we look over at Pony Espresso and the housing above, in many cases, the land values do push people to develop some housing above because that's a need as well as return on investment for property owners. So we do see about half of the commercial properties do develop housing on them. So we only wanted to represent that.
And Transit Triangle would be an example of where we are really.
Yeah, so the efforts that the city is taking to modify the zoning code in order to encourage more housing above commercial, hopefully that these deflated estimates will be far exceeded. But nonetheless, to be conservative in terms of land supply, because they're not obligated to provide residential housing, it makes sense to adjust those outcomes lower. Yeah.
Would the city ever consider workforce housing on the upper, adding floors to their city buildings? And
you know, this building, interestingly enough, when it was developed as one of the conditions of approval through the Planning Commission, was that they had to engineer it to accommodate an additional story. So it's already built to handle an additional story. That would, you know, to have residences upstairs, you'd probably have to look at parking issues that would come into play.
But the co-op was looking at that.
Yeah, and we do exempt parking in the downtown for even residential, so there could be potential of doing that.
I also thought on the cottage housing, the use of a single electric vehicle mm-hmm. help them avoid having to provide more parking
places.
Yes.
So
right, and they're trying to do they have to do a transportation demand management study to show that it actually does offset the number of parking. In case of the cottage housing, they're providing the 12 parking spaces they have, and they're providing an electric vehicle. Mm-hmm. A lot of the neighbor there felt that 12 spaces for 12 units was too little, but that is what the code allows. So the electric parking space and car may help offset that a little bit. So within the UGB, I've got 663 net buildable acres of land, 313 that are classified as developable within the city limits. Looking at the dwelling unit capacity, 1,563 units could be accommodated on lands within the city limits, using, again, the existing zoning designations and not using those bonuses or considering accessory residential units or cottage housing. All of those could increase that number. And a little over 2,800 units within the entire urban growth boundary. I have some interesting slides, and I know we're short on time, so I'll go through these pretty quickly, but I wanted to give an overview of some of the issues that go into what will come in when we do the housing needs analysis. Because population projections, those estimates, based on historic trends as well as current trends, they help commissions such as yourselves as well as the Planning Commission and City Council forecast what necessary changes might be needed in order to accommodate changing populations, both in terms of number and demographic makeup. So we get our population forecast from the Population Research Center through PSU, and that is state mandated. And they did provide a population estimate for 2018 through 2068. And it has a number of assumptions on it that as the economy strengthens, Oregon's population ages, and assume in net migration will continue throughout the decades. But birth rates have been going down, fertility rates decreased.
I got a question about that, because I looked at the, not only here, but I got something handed to me that had the population things, and so we're only going up, in 40 years, we're only going up a couple thousand people, and you look at all the other cities, they're like doubling.
I know.
I mean, I thought the state land use planning didn't let that happen. I mean, I thought there was some notion that all cities were supposed to contribute sort of equally or about both affordable housing and housing development. And this would look like we're off the hook for housing development a lot because we have a really abnormally weird population.
Yeah, and I think it probably has to do with our aging population,
the
people that are living in Ashland and in migration to Ashland.
Fastest growing group is above 80 and above because the 80-year-olds are living. And it used to be that
they died.
80s, they died.
So, and it's a small portion, but it's the fastest growing, even though it's a small portion.
And then you get to the age, people of childbearing age moving out of the community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that is not the same thing that's happening in Medford or in Grants Pass.
Right.
So it's not a negotiated that they'll grow more so that we can grow less. I think the population research center really does look at the age demographics, the income demographics in an area, land values, and historic development trends. Mm-hmm. We have been growing at less than 1% a year
for
a long time,
for a while.
Yeah.
So we're not likely to see the 3% growth rates that some other communities are looking at.
I think it's, and I'm not going to say anything more because we're running out of time, but I do think it's something that we ought to consider as we're thinking about sort of the opposite of getting more families, mm-hmm. getting low-income people, kind of expanding affordable housing. This would sort of say, not so much. and so I'm just thinking that along the way, we should pay a lot of attention to this.
And I would say that the PSU report is state mandated for every community in the state at this point. So cities don't do their own population enumeration or estimates going forward, and that was adopted by the state legislature. It's nice in that cities have access to this information, especially small cities that wouldn't normally do it. But I think this reflects your point.
Yes.
Jackson County growing 100,000 people, of which Ashland would get 2,600.
And that came up in our housing forum when they were talking about Milwaukee and the work they were doing, Milwaukee, Oregon, right? Milwaukee, am I saying that right? That they're really working together because they want a balanced community. And so they're really trying to figure out how do we get it more affordable so that we don't be flat and just old. Old and flat. Who wants to be that?
Oh, that was fun.
So this is showing that it's not entirely flat in terms of the shift over the last 7 years with aging population in Ashland.
Okay.
Oddly, there is an increase in 25 to 34-year-olds in this red area.
Woohoo!
This was 2010 census. This is current community survey. So there is an increase in the number of people in that age group, mm-hmm. but I think you'll see the largest increase, as you were indicating, in the this age group over here.
Yeah, look at that, 65 to 74 years, that red.
Yep.
Yeah,
and then
this,
you can see it's just coming up. 85 plus is starting to tip. I am meeting people over 100 years old at the senior center. They regularly come in and watch us line dance. 101, 102, not unusual anymore.
You know, when we get to the housing needs analysis, how many people, we're talking the population increase, how many housing units will those people need? If there's fewer people per household, it's more housing units, it's more land consumption. And this shows that the number of people per household has declined steadily over the last five decades.
Only two people.
Yeah.
There's some big old houses that have
big old houses with one person. But, I mean, to make go down.
Yeah, and in 1980 it was, you know, closer to 2.36. I mean, they seem like marginal changes, but that actually is a pretty good reflection in terms of what makes up the average household. And this, I think, shows it in stark terms that the we'll look at all households, both renter and owner combined. You're looking at nearly 77% of all households in Ashland are one- or two-person households at this point in time.
Yes.
And so that's less than a quarter of the households have three or more people in them. And that compares to a national average of 52% of households have one or two people in them.
Yeah.
So the traditional single-family detached housing development pattern, I would say, is mismatched with the increasing number of smaller household sizes that we're seeing in our community. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at our existing housing stock, there are a lot of existing single-family homes. And so, you know, you're not necessarily changing that existing stock, but what kind of housing do we need to build going forward to close that gap? Again, the purview of a housing needs analysis. But some other data that was interesting when presented to the Housing or Planning Commission, we only had the blue bars on here in terms of the average home sizes in Ashland over the last, you know, 18 years. And you can see that during the recession, 2009, 2010, 11, average home size decreased considerably. And then it started to creep back up. But I think like 2015, where you see 2,349 as an average home size, that is skewed dramatically due to a number of very large homes.
Yes.
And a very small sample size of the number of units built.
Yes.
So I think we only had 42 units built in that year. And I was looking through those to try and understand why that average height. And found one that had a 3,900 square foot garage.
Just the house.
Garage.
Yeah, the house right down the street.
So when you look at those kind of, you know, 6,000 square foot homes and a number of those, even though we are now starting to see an increasing number of smaller housing units built, like cottage housing and ARUs and those, that's what the, I'd say the orange line better references is that median house size. And we are seeing median house size really down to 1,738, which is even less than the median was in the middle of the recession. So it probably is a reflection that Ashland's market does promote smaller household size, and that's being recognized by the development community as well. So I mentioned the 1,563 new dwelling units could be accommodated within the city, two people per household. That would accommodate 3,126 residents.
Which is more than we are projected to have.
Correct. But, you know, a lot of those railroad properties that I showed in blue, those people aren't going to build a second unit on their side yard.
Right.
It's inventory. It may not be available tomorrow. May not be available 10 years from now. At some point it might be. But, again, I think, so looking at annexation from outside the city limits may be needed, especially for larger scale developments.
So, Brandon, just a question looking at that picture. Isn't that right near the 243 apartment complex that the guy came
Yeah, this is within the city limits.
But just to the right of that.
Yeah, so to the right of it,
is
a little further would be
acres?
The, yeah, it would be the railroad over, once you get out of town.
Yeah.
And then the apartment.
Is anything happening with that, the 243?
They have submitted an application that may go to the Planning Commission on November 12th.
Whoa.
It's not a full application for the site review for all the apartments. They're really trying to get a read on the annexation and what off-site improvements would be required.
But that's more workforce housing.
Yeah.
And that would
apartments
be.
Apartments by definition.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, over the period of 2011 to 2018, again, when the last BLI was done, population in Ashland was 20,255 in 2011. It's 20,815 now, which means 560 new residents over that whole period of time. And so it's just something that when we talk about accommodating, you know, 2,000 new residents over a long period of time, if it takes 8 years to accommodate 500, it's a really long-range projection. And again, that's reflective of those slow growth rates. So I think that about closes the presentation. I did want to, you know, mention again that the next steps are the housing needs analysis. I mean, we have the Planning Commission and the City Council that will review this technical document, and there's a resolution in your packet that would be going to the City Council. Planning Commission and the Housing and Human Services could provide a recommendation of whether the city should adopt that resolution. I do want to say that the housing needs analysis, which again would be the next phase, would include that evaluation of socioeconomic characteristics, age, income, employment trends, which this document doesn't really go into.
Does it take in students, like from SOU, trying to get housing in the community?
Yeah, and you know, there is a gap in your document about student housing. We have subsequently got information from SOU about their housing units, and they did provide, ultimately, I think they have 47 single-family housing units that are for student family housing. I shouldn't say single-family housing units. Let me get the number from you. So it will pull that in. I know I was at a meeting at the that you were all in attendance at, or many of you, last Monday, where the question was asked.
Yes, that's what made me think of it.
Yeah.
The housing form.
You know, if there's 5,000 students, are they providing 5,000 dwelling units? A lot of their students are non-traditional students that already have housing or don't live in Ashland. But for those
homeless.
Or homeless.
Or homeless, that's right. They pointed
but
that
a lot
out.
Of students don't have adequate housing, and probably the SOU could do some to address that. They did provide updated statistics subsequent to when our packet was printed to now in terms of the total number of housing units that they have. So they maintain 1,094 residence hall dormitory beds.
Okay.
And 165 apartment units. And then in terms of...
Is that one student per apartment? Or
no.
Is that
when we say apartment units, those are student family housing. So it may have more than one student, but it may be a single mother. It may be a couple where one person's a student, or it could be that both are students. But what was interesting to me in looking at their existing number of units and their existing number of people that are living in the dormitories and living in the units was that they have a considerable vacancy rate relative to the city's vacancy rate. Which may be a reflection of the cost of dormitory living.
And the kids leaving because they want to get out of their
rent. No, I mean, at this point, they're in school. They're in session.
Okay.
With those number of units, they were housing 763 students in residence halls. And, again, they have a capacity of 1,094.
That's interesting.
And they had, again, some... so essentially, they could accommodate another 331 students within the dormitories and another 28 households in SOU-owned apartments and family housing. And there's always vacancy rate fluctuation as people come and go, as you mentioned. Hmm. But those are, you know, at a 30% vacancy rate is much higher than...
Again, that was, like, really, really good. I think we learned a lot about a very complicated thing, but we do have to roll on. And Linda has provided for us.
Yeah, thank you. That was great.
If you look on our our packet, there's a suggested motion that we would make if we want to approve this for future, you know, to go forward.
I would just like to thank you, Brandon, for putting this together because 2011 is a little long. So thanks for doing that.
Yeah, really, that is great educational
great
job.
Presentation. Yeah. And you're so quick. You have the answers when people ask questions.
He knows this stuff.
You know this
I'm
stuff.
I'm prepared for the meeting.
Yeah, okay. It shows. It shows. Okay, but we're trying to find
would
you.
Someone like to just say, I move the potential motion?
To recommend approval to the City Council of a resolution updating the buildable lands inventory technical report referenced in the comprehensive plan appendix entitled Technical Reports and Supporting Documents. That's my motion.
I'll second.
Thank you. Moved and seconded. Any discussion? All in favor of adopting the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion is passed, and thank you for getting us through that point. If you look at the agenda, we're going to be on sort of like speed dating.
You're doing a great job,
Rich. To get through some of these. But the next thing on there is a debrief of our housing forum that we had. And so we're just going to kind of open it up to kind of what we learned and what our next steps are and ideas about it.
It was wonderful. I got to tell you, I had nothing to do with the planning, and so I had no real expectations, you know, when I came in. And I just thought the panel was so good, and Linda and I were saying the conversations, and Linda did such a great job of just graciously welcoming everyone, and you kept us all calm. You know, no one got all too excited.
I'm going to claim credit for that.
Yeah, but there was a little agitation, but it was really good conversations. And, of course, for me, the only downside is I wish there were 50 more people there at least. Mm-hmm. But maybe you have to start small like that in order to have these conversations, these personal conversations with those panel members. And the attorney... I just love him. Michael, oh my gosh. Stay out of court, you know, and let's not go to court. Let's problem solve on both sides with tenants and landlords. That was my big thankful aha, because that's how it should be. It was awesome.
So other...
I thought it was good. Big feedback that I got from a lot of people listening to them is, I wish we could do this more often.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, can you guys do it again?
Yeah, but it's
and
like,
they have no idea how hard it was.
They have no idea. I know.
I heard that. I wish we could. And I was emailing with Linda afterwards, and she was telling me, she goes, Gina, it's a lot of work. And I know that. But something that I really liked out of it, too, our panel was great.
They were.
But the resources. Because I talked to people, and we can't do this again next month. However, you can use these resources.
Like Pam.
Yes. And then
from
she
Milwaukee.
Had her card. And
yeah.
We had information on our website for people to go and get resources. And people had questions that were dear to them and personal to them, and so they could go and do that. And to me, it's so important that we put the resources out mm-hmm. there. Yeah. If we didn't touch this on this time, please look into it. The resources there, so that something that I think our goal was to be able to give people some resources, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that you just don't walk away going, oh, well, that was a waste of time. You know, or having more questions than you had when you got there. So,
I just love the conversation. What Pam was saying from CAT, C-A-T,
yes.
And what does that stand for? Something like Community
Alliance of Tenants.
Community Alliance of Tenants.
Oh,
and when she talked about, again, back to Milwaukee, mm-hmm. my family's from Milwaukee, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, so it probably sticks. But just that affordable housing discussion.
Working together. Yes.
It was such a strong partnership. Mm-hmm. And I thought, we should learn from them. Yeah, somehow.
Yes.
How do we learn from them?
Well, see, I thought she was a great resource for us.
Yes.
I thought she was a great resource for us. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. The wheel's been made. Mm-hmm. How can we adapt it to our truck, our wagon?
Mm-hmm. And maybe she could do the work to pull things together to start a conversation. And
she
then we're just supporting and sitting at the outside tables, listening and helping, writing down comments.
I would say, just interesting enough, the reflection in social media was positive, but it was positive from the standpoint of, that sounds great, but I wasn't there.
Yeah.
So that's just a little.
Did we invite
note.
The press? That was something that, of course, hit me as I'm sitting there going, oh, I wish there were more people here. So that would be a recommendation the next time, is to invite Caitlin Fowkes.
You know, we did last time.
I thought Sarah was
Spancel.
Inviting somebody from Jefferson Radio.
I don't think we
well,
had
Jason.
Any.
Jason was there.
Oh. Yeah. But
well,
not
Jason,
in the media.
Yeah, Howe,
media.
But he doesn't, you know, he has his KSKQ. But.
So my other thought, there were renter advocates that were quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure what that was about. And at least one set of recommendations from CAP came to me before the meeting and that they didn't raise up in the meeting.
Interesting.
Mm. I just think the thing that for us is, I think the next step is, and we're going to get ready to do, is talk about our retreat coming up. And so, like, one of the jobs that we have to do is try to synthesize a little bit of this to put into what we're going to do next. So.
I would like to see somebody like Pam come and talk to us about how do you start the conversation in your community. Because I am worried about being flat and old in this community. I want us to be balanced. I want young families to want to live here. It's a joke. Liz laughed because it's a joke, right? And young families don't stay around here very easily anyway.
It's pricey.
And they do three jobs to
the
try
cost
to
of the land.
Yeah, and well, to go to our schools, which are so great.
Maybe you brought that up. Workforce housing, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
that would keep young folks here. I mean, people graduate, they're gone, they're out of here. Or people live in Medford or Talon.
And we have a chance here. I mean, there is this. You remember the guy? What's his name? It starts with a K.
Bob.
Kendrick. Remember when Kendrick came and talked about the 243?
We're going to do that.
Oh, okay.
So.
But think about how the not in my backyard it's going to be. I mean, that's just so Ashland.
Yeah. I think it's important to think about continuing this conversation
with some of the organizations here, because one of the things that Jeff Golden brought up, which is that we do have a property management company here that is consistently doing, you know, raising the rent
the
one month after they move in. Exactly.
CPM.
And one of the big reasons that a lot of people do move out of Ashland, these are friends of mine who are in that 25 to 40 year age range, is because there is a lot of unethical stuff going on.
Right.
And they're pushing themselves to the law. And can we actually step in? And that's a justice situation that that it is a problem in this community. And so I think that that's a piece that's really important to not forget. And why I like the I don't remember who it was who brought up that they were bringing landlords together to talk about how can we not price gouge.
That was Pam in Milwaukee.
And so that's what we need to do. Yeah. We talked about this afterwards, that we need to create a culture here where price gouging is not celebrated.
That's right.
And you know what? I think having Pam, and I like Mike Stout.
Oh,
attorney,
I love him. He
that would be
great.
A good question for him. How can we stop that? How can we go around that? And then also, a woman who was the landlord kind of brought it up, but I remember last year it was brought up, the utilities.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God, okay, I can pay my rent, but I can't afford to have any lights or water.
And I got to move it on to the tenants.
Yes.
I will say just what he talked about with energy conservation, because I live in an apartment where my landlord built it for energy conservation, and my energy bill is typically $40 to $50 a month with AC and heat, and it's because of that energy conservation.
That's
now,
amazing.
I live in an apartment, not in some huge house, but again, there's like other pieces there too that if we can actually incorporate some of that, that's the other thing is how is that energy being used and what do those look like? How are they being built up?
So do you think that we could get Kat and Mike back? I'll talk to Mike. He's
that'd
my
be
bestie.
Awesome.
So, well, not bestie, because I think I kind of ask him a weird question, but that's okay, you got over it. But Ken, do you think we can have them talk to us?
Mm-hmm. I think that'd be really good. Maybe we could bring
them retreat,
to the retreat.
Can we do that?
The retreat? We kind of moved into the retreat.
We're going to move into that, and so let's just, I guess we can wrap up this section and go to the next things on the agenda, but I've also just, everybody should look at this piece too. We have many of those, or one?
Take the agenda for a second.
So the next thing on the agenda is reviewing the report to the City Council, which comes up on the 5th? 4th or 5th?
November 3rd.
What?
November 5th.
They meet on December 3rd, the City Council.
December?
No, no, our November. Report is coming up.
November 5th.
November
5th.
Yeah,
right. So I don't know if people had a chance to read the report, and it looks like it's very comprehensive.
I did. I read it. Yeah.
My only thought was that one might edit it. I don't want to put any more work on it, but one might edit it in terms of layout, in terms of it's now just kind of a long, narrative versus maybe breaking it into little more peaceable sections that might make it a little, because I'm concerned that the City Council might not read it.
You know what I liked about it, though? I want to give you some positive feedback. I really like the way you mentioned the different projects, or whoever, did Linda write it?
Linda.
Okay, but the way she talked about, like one such project, the Addictions Recovery Center, Community Engagement Mobile Response Unit, and it's providing the transportation, and comparing that to CAHOOTS, which is in Eugene, and is a great program, Eugene and Springfield, and she did that a couple of times, La Clinica, and that to me, at my brief time on the council, I love to hear the personal project and what the money is going for and what's it doing, and to really explain that. That's excellent.
I wanted to, I also put down that we did do, it was kind of behind the scenes a little bit, but we did have a meeting with the Senior Advisory Committee to talk about what we do and what they do, and then they came to our meeting and talked a little, and we were part of that. So
are we talking about SAC? Is this VCOG? What am I? The Senior Advisory Committee.
Whatever. The Senior
RVCOG?
Center.
Oh, the Senior Center. Okay, so in town. Okay, yeah.
Right, so we exchanged
Ashland
board
Senior
meetings.
Senior Advisory, yeah.
What?
It's called ASAC.
ASAC.
ASAC, uh-huh.
We did exchange kind of meeting with each other as a way to, and we discussed.
And Valencia told me you came to their meeting and you had a discussion.
Right, and Linda, and we discussed kind of policy issues that reflect senior housing kinds of things. And I think it's significant to talk about because as we move forward, as we can see, senior housing is a important part. So I think we could add a little thing to that. But
that'd be great. That would be great.
Yeah.
To add that, because so people will be listening.
You and
to
I
that.
Are on board.
Or yeah, with presenting, absolutely.
Okay, so I don't know that we have to do more other than when Linda gets ready, we can play a little bit with the actual printout for it. So.
Yeah, I almost wonder if we could even do something like a bulleted list or something here. Right. That would just be really quick for them to.
To go to make it just a little more readable.
At least for the social service grant, right?
Aren't you going to sort of read it to them in addition to them getting the copy? Won't you?
Yeah, we're going to do highlights. We're not going to read it necessarily, but we're going to present
it. They give you 3 to 5 minutes
to
do this, and so we have to just kind of highlight what's there, and Linda will be there to do all that, but. If we don't have it sort of just jump off the page, they may never read it, and
right.
It is worthwhile.
Right.
So, I mean, I would just say the summary of it is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
So that's what we want to say.
I thought that this was, I agree with you.
Yeah, I love that.
I thought this was really
the examples,
Examples are good. I think it helps people understand.
Okay.
It's a story. It's telling a story, you know.
I think it does.
Okay.
In fact, here's a quick, really quick story with the homeless shelter. Shirley Patton is one of our overnight hosts, and she's a regular.
Yeah, wow.
You all know Shirley Patton, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Am I getting that right?
Grand Dame of Ashland.
Shirley Patton is one of our overnight hosts at the homeless shelter. She's amazing. I think it'd be great to get something in there, though, about what are we doing for seniors.
For seniors?
Yeah, with the affordable housing. And the concept, one of the things that is out there, and I know you're interested in this too, is the more we can do, you know, adding on the small units,
ADUs.
Yeah, the ADUs, so that you can get more people living in these big homes, you know, with one person. Mm-hmm. And then this multi-generational concept that, you know, where we can get seniors and younger people living together in the same.
Just keep thinking there's a nonprofit in the making there of seniors that are trying to hang on to their houses and younger people who are needing a place to live and, you know, willing to rent a room or, you know, there's a marriage to be made there because we're not going to get rid of all of our big old beautiful houses, you know, but they're sitting there with one person in them a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
Who's trying to keep it up, trying to hang on to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. But they don't know each other. Somebody need a yenta here.
How do you,
So anybody that feels motivated to share some of this with Linda and I, and maybe we'll get Heidi, and we'll see how we can.
Is Aaron going with you, or is Heidi going with you?
Aaron's going with us. But I think we can present, but the question is what is the written thing that we get down there, but we can hear what you
bullets
all say.
Are good, probably. Bullets are good.
And
but the spoken story then can be quick and doing the, you know.
If anybody
on the next to the last page, under education and outreach, it talks about, it really focuses on 2017 and 2018.
I was curious about that as well.
That just adds to the length of this and not.
It
doesn't clarify the readability of it, so I would take that section out. I keep the education feature that we just did, but not the other stuff.
Okay.
No, it's outreach. I mean, that's the only thing.
And
I mean,
it has
I remember.
The other side
yeah.
The, to that.
That was at Ashland Hills, too.
Yeah,
you did that
outreach.
This
is an annual report, and I'm sure that was
okay.
In past
oh,
reports.
That's a good idea. Oh, I think that's good, then. If this is an annual report, okay, I agree with you. I agree with you.
So, looking at the time, so we have a couple of things to look at. One, I think before we set the holiday schedule, can we look at this document from
Robert Kendrick addressed it to the Housing and Human Services Commission, and I did provide him a response.
It's a great response.
But I thought that both should probably be provided to the commission.
No, I think that's an excellent response.
Can you summarize your response? Because we
the summary of the response is that he was asking why the Housing Commission wasn't advocating for his proposal to the Planning Commission and the City Council. Or the Planning Commission coming up. There's a packet provided to the Planning Commission, and it didn't include any kind of statement of support from the Housing
Commission.
Like
the recommendation we made to the City Council, basically.
That was relating to funding.
Yeah.
But he's talking about his land use application.
Right.
So I essentially responded that the City Council, in crafting powers and duties for the Commission, did allow the Housing and Human Services Commission to review at the pre-app in order to provide him information to frame his project, but is not part of the land use review process by which we notice that it's a public hearing and you have testimony from neighbors at your meeting. And so, unlike the Transportation Commission that reviews transportation issues,
or the tree people,
tree that evaluates landscaping and trees, the Housing Commission really provides recommendations to the applicant and policies to the council. And so that's why he didn't see anything in the packet, and that you're not necessarily an advocacy group for individual projects, more for broader policy. And he did respond, thank you for the email that it answered his general question of why it wasn't in there.
I have a question. I mean, he seemed to imply in his letter that it's like potentially not going to happen.
Well, I think it hasn't been reviewed as of yet by the Planning Commission, so it's probably premature to.
So he's just a little nervous.
There's a lot of things have to happen. We have to annex the property, and there's a lot of steps in this.
Right, and staff was, to be fair, was a little critical of the application because it didn't include the number of units, didn't show which units would be affordable and where. It's very general in those sense, and so staff's recommendation had been, we can take it forward, but we're going to have a recommendation that it will have to go through again with the site review to show that it meets all of those requirements for affordability standards as well as the site design standards.
I see it's gone down to 196 here, because I remember it was more like 242 or 243.
Yeah, and the 196 was a determination that we made based on the number of parking spaces that they're providing.
Yes.
That is likely what was being provided before. So
we should buy them a few electric cars.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I think they have some substantial issues in terms of infrastructure improvements, water sewer connectivity, as well as transportation sidewalk improvements. And before they spend, considerably more money doing final design of buildings to submit for planning approval, they want to go through the process to have the Planning Commission and City Council weigh in on the annexation portion.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
That makes sense, yeah.
More to come.
More to come.
All right. Thank you, Brandon. This was put together.
Wonderful.
So the next and last thing before we get to report is we need to decide on our meeting schedule for November and December. So how did we do our retreat last December?
I don't know, guys, but tell me,
did
we skip 1 month of meeting and then schedule a longer meeting?
I think so.
No, I think we had all our meetings, but we changed them.
The date.
Right. And so our meeting would come.
So December 6th at 4:30, we had a Housing and Human Services meeting. December 6th. Let me see if I can go into it.
That must have been the retreat thing.
I'm guessing. That isn't letting me look
Ashland
at it.
Ashland Hills.
Yeah, no, I can't
think of it. You were here?
I missed it because I was gone. I was traveling for the holidays.
It was at Ashland Hills because I remember I had to leave and go to Christmas party.
Okay, now I have one though also. Galaxy Room, and this was on November 15th. Housing Human Services Galaxy Room, Ashland Hills.
That's the one
Hotel.
I left at.
It was November 15th.
That was our hearing.
That was our big meeting.
Oh, your forum.
That was our forum.
The forum. Oh, okay. In November? Yeah. Okay, then December 6th must have been the actual retreat, I'm guessing. Well, I have one on the 20th, though, too. Okay, well, maybe my... Oh, wait. So the one I'm showing on the 20th is the one that says Ashland Hills at Retreat. And it started at 3:30 and went to 6:30.
That's right.
Okay.
We have pizza.
Yeah. So December 20th. I mean, do you want to look at that kind of similar...
I don't want it to be that late. That's, like, basically Christmas.
I know. It is. I agree. I agree.
Did you guys determine, I'm sorry, a November meeting date?
No.
Okay.
Not yet.
Yeah, so are we going to have a meeting in November and December and a retreat? Is that the plan?
I think we should make the November one.
Let me just say, am I right? Is it would be on the 21st, but Thanksgiving is the 28th?
Right. Yeah.
Correct.
So we could just go with the 21st.
Yeah, if you guys want to do
okay.
that.
Okay. Is that...
Well, let me see. Okay, so let's see.
For our regular meeting?
That would be our regular meeting at the regular time.
Would be the
21st.
November. That's our regular Thursday.
From 4 to 6?
I don't think so.
No, it's the 28th.
Thanksgiving
the
is our 28th.
It's on Thanksgiving.
We're the fourth Thursday.
Well, let's go with the 3rd.
I could do the 3rd.
The 21st? The 21st?
Yeah.
So wait, we're going for the 21st, right?
That's what we're thinking about,
meeting.
Yeah. If everybody's on that.
Why not the 28th?
It's Thanksgiving Day.
Okay. Yeah.
You're right. So this room is available on Thursday the 21st.
Great.
At 4 o'clock, is that?
Okay,
so now the last decision is when in December or any time before the end of the year would we want to have a goal-setting meeting with
not
a little longer time and an opportunity to sift through all of these
not
things
Mondays.
And come through our plan.
Well, that's true. Not Monday. I am right.
I mean, are we looking at a Thursday?
December 26th.
I mean, we don't have to other than...
It's easier if people have already got
If we've already kind of set Thursdays, but the one that we would have is too close to Christmas, so we wouldn't use that.
Are you going to host us again, Gina?
I hope so.
I could take a look. Give me some dates.
Well, you tell us some dates. We can meet in your...
Is there a better date?
The 5th is your birthday?
Yeah, the 5th is my birthday.
Okay. 5th of December.
Okay. No.
It's my best friend's birthday.
Oh, cool. What about the 12th?
The 12th would be awesome.
Because we don't want to do the 19th.
I would not be able to make it. I'm in a play performance, Café Noir. So that whole week... The 9th through the 15th, I am not available.
Let me think, because we're not, I know that there's so many holiday parties, you know, at the hotels.
Mm-hmm.
So the closer we're away from, we even have some on Thursday. So you know what?
What about the week before, the week between?
Even if we did it the 5th or the 4th.
How about the 4th?
That's my husband's birthday.
So
have to throw out birthdays.
Well, I don't know.
I know. We don't move.
He doesn't always remember what day it is.
Are you talking about the regular meeting or retreat?
No, retreat.
Okay.
All right. What about doing Tuesday the 3rd or 10th?
I can't do it the 10th. But I could do it.
I can do the third.
The third.
Tuesdays are good, too. It's earlier in the week.
And I would say this room's not available that week. So,
no, so that's why we want to go to Gina's.
That whole week.
That whole week. Yeah. There's
what about
audit commission.
Aha.
What about the 19th? Is that too close to Christmas?
It is.
Are people going away?
I could do it the
19th. I'm not going away, but there's just a lot of events for the holidays, and I'm just concerned it's going to be an issue.
I like the third.
I like the third.
I like the third. How's the third?
I'm in Mexico.
Oh, lucky guy.
When do you get back?
We'll give you some stickers you can stick on from Mexico.
I get back the 12th.
Oh, the 12th. Oh. The 17th, or is that too close?
I can do the 17th.
I can do the 17th.
17th going once. 17th. Going twice. I would just to make sure we're all right. So the 17th, okay. And we can get this room.
No,
we
want to go to
Ashland Hills. 17th, this room is available as Ashland Hills.
Is not.
Okay.
We want Ashland Hills, though, Gina.
It depends on what time.
We want Ashland Hills. And what time?
What time is the retreat? Because the room is occupied at certain times.
Four is good. I like the earlier time.
Start at 4 and go for 3 hours.
What about 3:30? 3:30 to 6:30.
We did that last time, yeah, 3:30.
3:30 to 6:30.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what we did last year.
The 17th?
Yes.
And
in Ashland Hills.
Okay.
And what I'll do is I'll email you, Rich. I'll look at it tomorrow.
Okay.
Awesome. And it works so much, I feel like I live there. Come on over to my house.
Yeah.
It's terrible to have a hotel. You can actually stay there. Okay. So, what's our retreat?
So if
December 17th. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Everybody's got all those down. We're all set. Mm-hmm. So is there, Brandon, do you have a staff, anything from that we need to know about that would be in the report? Liaison-y. All right. So are there any announcements? I do have one, but anybody else?
What's yours?
Go ahead.
I think the sweep out is going to be happening the 2nd of November.
Yeah, that's right.
It's Saturday night.
It's the Aura sweep out. That's right.
And it's a fundraiser for the shelters. People sleep outside. It's always an interesting experience. It makes you empathize with people who are unsheltered.
And Heidi, you said it's a fundraiser. So if somebody cannot be there, how can we raise funds?
So you, from the Ashland Community Resource Center, you can get pledge forms. And you get people to pledge a certain amount if you sleep out.
Okay.
You can also go on our website, helpingashland.org, and PayPal.
Okay.
PayPal always works.
Yeah,
I do have
PayPal.
Two announcements.
Okay. So we're 5 over, but I did want to share an issue about mental health in the jail.
Oh.
And so, you know, Ashland voted to not support the $100 million levy, and it's coming back. And in between, the sheriff has had lots and lots and lots of meeting with mental health people and other folks about what could go and what is going to go into the new jail and the levy that created it. And I just got to say that what I've got is, it was reported on the news today, so I could let it out, but NAMI, National Association of Mentally Ill, has come up with 4 criteria, conditions that they want, after being at every meeting, with every mental health and sheriff person for the last few months. They've dug in, and this is a tremendously excellent set of conditions that they put on.
It's a great organization. NAMI's great.
So I've got some copies if people would like to see.
I'd like to see them.
I relate it because right now the decision is coming to Ashland. The study session on it is November 4th, I think. And then on the 2 weeks from that next, the second meeting in November, I think, is the where the city council will make a decision on whether they support it or not.
So this is coming to our city council, their study session November 4th.
Let me say the way that it is. It's going to all the city councils in Jackson County, really significant ones, and it's coming through the door of the public forum.
Oh, okay.
So there will be people showing up at, I think, on the 5th, and they're going to do a, this is what we're presenting. It's now been out. They presented it to the county commission. Lots of discussion. It was on the news tonight because I heard it on the way over. So I just say, take a look and read it because I think it does represent a really decent way of looking at where we're going with criminal justice.
Does it address the number of professional staff that would be available to deliver?
It's pretty much in there about levels of support in the levy for programs and staff, and the biggest ask is a new center that would be developed as an outpatient center for people. You have to read it to understand it. But this is not being done outside of the groups that have been meeting with the sheriff, with mental health, with everyone involved in it to know exactly what are the details that are going on right now and what could. This is an extension. It's asking a little more than what would be in there as it exists. And really, this is just my own personal view of the politics of it. The only place that has leverage is Ashland. That is the decision right there.
Wow.
Is that, and so when you hear that, but it's also a place to reflect on where we could go as a community for mental health in Southern Oregon in relation to the jails.
So on November the 4th, it's going to council. Is it going to be voted on?
Well, the Monday the 4th, I think it's a Monday.
Yes,
It's a study session where they're going to go over all of it. But I don't think it comes a couple weeks later. It's not the next meeting, but it's the meeting after that it's scheduled to go to the city council for a vote.
The 19th?
The 19th. And Sickler is going to be there this time. And so that'll be probably the crucial vote for whether this whole thing goes through.
And that'll show up on the website. You can go and when they post the agenda, you'll be able to see that. Just, I have a real short one. It's just we're going to have a open house for volunteers for the winter shelter. It's October 30th, which is coming up next week, right?
Yeah.
At 5:30 p.m. So it's just open house. You can see all the cots. You can see the facility, and it's just open for people. So.
Great.
Yeah.
I also wanted to
5:30.
October 4th, I went to a fair housing workshop here for shelters. This whole room was packed.
Wow.
And it was really an excellent presentation.
Who did it?
Louise Dix.
All right, good.
Came down to Portland. Good. It was really great.
Okay, we're adjourned.
Yay!
Thank you,
good work. Thanks for all the support for Aura and the winter shelter. Bless you all.
Yay!
Oh,
you're welcome.
Thank you. All right. See you next time.
Okay.
Rich, I'll email you and let you know the availability.
Okay. You were talking about just coming to the city council about understanding the
interest. Thank you, Brandon, for coming in. It's always nice to close
the second
one.
Oh, you just put
it
on.
Kyle Taylor today
February, March.
So, basically, he broke it down for me on the Otis Street subdivision. What he paid for the property and how many housing lots he has.
You've got
infrastructure costs for each of
them.
So they're not coming
bare bones cost to him.
So, I mean, we've looked at, like, let's say land is free. You know, you don't pay anything for land. You just pay $150 a square foot for the building and labor. So let's say it's 1,000 square foot.
There's options.
That's $150,000 right there. Then you have to do another,
They'll do all
that. You have to do a sidewalk and utilities and probably another 20 or 190 before there's any profit whatsoever.
But in this case,
for 1,000 square foot building, now you may get 1,500. Now you're adding another,
we were talking about the cost of the those cottages that PDA is doing.
You mean over in
on Laurel Street?
The new ones?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we gave
oh, they are? Okay.
Yeah. The ones up on Verde Village get up to the some of them. I mean, the new ones that are happening in Verde Village are big.
How much are they?
But they're not.
The original 400. Ones, yeah.
Those are like 600. Yeah.
It could be that.
A shelter and an office.
It could. A year or two ago, they were not.
Is all. And the ones in the back are more because they're a townhome with a rental apartment on top.
And I know somebody that is renting one of those units for one bedroom for $1,400 a month.
I can't remember. It's over on the other side of Bi-Mart. and connect between Bi-Mart and the freeway off of somewhere in that over around the railroad tracks.
But I do think that it's a point that